Backseat Producers, episode number 260, Inglorious Bastards. Those first couple of sips of this were good, but Daryl's right. This is some hoppy stuff.
Yeah, it is. I mean, so it's too strong?
It's too strong for my taste. I mean,
the hoppiness eventually overwhelms you.
Yeah, I can see that.
I'm just not used to drinking it.
Unless you're an alcoholic. That's why I don't have a problem.
Well, there you go. This is like, you know, like a German dark beer. It's more the hop flavor, rather as opposed to the bitters, it's kind of an acquired taste. You just can't drink it all at once.
Right.
Kind of just sip on it every now and then.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, like American beers, which are really light and very, you know, watery flavored, you can drink them all day and get smashed really easily. This would be a little different, more difficult.
This is a very European style beer. It's the Schlafly Extra Stout Irish Style special release. And it'll be out of style after St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah. Right. So I've been getting into using my Comixology app to read some comic books.
On the 7?
On the
We just call it the 7 now. The 7, by the way.
Pretty soon it'll be the 007. when I get all sophisticated with it. But so there's a new video game coming out called Injustice, Gods Among Us, I think that's the name of it. And it is a Justice League of America-based fighting game, like a Street Fighter-style game.
Cool.
But it's got a story to it. So in advance of this game, which I think comes out in like April, they have been releasing every week I think it's like a 16-page, it's like 8 or 16-page comic book that you can get on Comixology for 99 cents. Or you can wait every month. They're collecting 3 of them and publishing 3 episodes or 3 of the mini ones for $4. So it's still cheaper to get it online. So I've been reading them, and it's set in an alternate universe. Spoilers: bad shit happens because the in the game the idea is that Superman has taken over the world and you need to take him down.
So he turned bad or something?
He just realized he's a god among insects.
Yeah, well, what happens is like in the first issue of this, it shows him and Lois in bed, and he's like, "Oh my god, I heard a second heartbeat inside her body. Okay. She's pregnant."
Okay.
So it's like, "Yay, she's pregnant. This is awesome." He goes and tells Batman, and he's like, "You'll never guess." And he's like, "Lois is pregnant." He's like, "How did you know?" He's like, "You're grinning like an idiot. And you don't get this excited about things." and he's like, "We want you to be the godfather." And Batman kind of gives a little smile. And it's one of those very stoic Batman. So just to see that he gives a little smile is really nice.
Yeah.
And like by the end of the first little episode, they're... Something happens and Lois has to go off on a reporter run thing. It's either in that one or in the second one, Jimmy Olsen gets killed. Bullet through the eyepiece of the camera that he's looking at.
Ooh, how
by
brutal.
The Joker.
Aye, aye, aye.
Nice.
They capture Lois and he's like, "Oh, I got a little Jimmy on my shoe." It is brutal. So by the third issue, and these are all real short, keep in mind, and this is, by the time it's collected, this is all in one comic book. Clark realizes something's wrong, Superman realizes something wrong, he busts in to trying to find out where Lois is to save her, and Doomsday shows up. And so he grabs Doomsday and flies up into the atmosphere. Turns out that the Joker was playing him and used some of Scarecrow's nerve gas, and he didn't take Doomsday up into the atmosphere. He took Lois. He took her out of the atmosphere, killed her and the baby.
So now he's...
He killed Lois and the baby.
Dude, that's crazy.
He comes back and is like, I'm going to end that madman. He tracks down the Joker with Batman standing right there. Batman's like, just calm down. He's like, I'm calm. Punches a hole through the Joker. Just punches a hole through him.
So this is like the Dark Knight Returns Superman style, basically.
But it's so good. The thing is, it's like it seems like it's kind of cheesy, but the way it's written is so good.
I don't necessarily think it's cheesy. I just think,
but
I
mean, and the idea
I just can't imagine Superman being that dark, I guess.
And that's the idea, that this is not the regular DCU.
It's alternate.
It's alternate.
Yeah.
So he gets to the point where he's like, this is dumb. This is dumb that we've let it get to this point. I've been too reactionary. I need to be proactive. This needs to stop. No more wars. He goes to some little Middle East country, strips the dictator, takes him to the UN, says, here's the deal. There's to be an immediate ceasefire. I'm calling it. If you don't, then I will enforce the ceasefire.
So,
and that's kind of where it.
And is that where the video game begins?
No, it's the story's still going.
Oh,
I'm still reading the comic book, and I think it like the comic book leads all the way up to April, and that was where the last one just ended. They've only had like six of these issues.
Does the video game update with the comic, or?
Well, the video game comes out. I think the comic book will have led up to...
Well, the video game's not even out yet.
No, it's not out until April.
Okay. Very cool.
So I think the story's going to get us to the point of when the comic book ends, the video game begins. I believe that's
kind of cool.
It is kind of cool. And the thing is that the story is so good. The writing is really tight, which is surprising for a video game tie-in.
Yeah, you know? I mean, because video game tie-ins are usually...
Throwaways, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so anyway, on to what we're really here for.
The Inglorious Bastards.
We didn't ever really introduce ourselves. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And this is Tony.
We are the Backseat Producers, and I have got a bunch to edit out because we're at the 41-minute mark of recording. Oh,
you don't need to edit any of that out. That's gold. So, I think some of the best stuff, because I've been going back and listening to a lot of episodes recently, and I think some of the best stuff...
Is when we start meandering.
Is just the stuff we talk. We just talk. Yeah. And it makes the show what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
That's our thesis.
So next week we're going to have a surprise episode.
Well, maybe. Surprise for the people who supposedly care about what we've been saying we were going to do. Next week we were going to do Django. We don't know if we are now, right?
Yeah. We've got... Supposedly, a big bad mother of a storm coming in tomorrow, which will probably be mostly gone by Friday. But you never know. And the fact is that this movie came out almost 2 months ago at this point. So it's getting harder to find in the theaters around here. There are none. I would say the closest theater to me right now is, what'd you say, about 15 miles? Ronnie's?
That's 15 miles.
It's about
15 at least.
Miles.
Yeah.
And it's not a straight, 15-mile shot. It's driving through St. Louis and south. But so it could be less than hoppable for me to try to catch it this week. But I might still try.
So we'll see.
We'll see. And if not, we'll just come up with some alternate.
DiCaprio's in it, so my wife might go see it with me.
Well, that
makes it easy on me.
That makes it a lot easier. My wife will not see it with me.
Really?
So, she has no interest
in it. She doesn't have a crush on Jamie Foxx or Hans Landa, whatever his real name is.
Is that Christoph Waltz?
Yes. Don Johnson's in the movie? Come
is
on.
Is he really?
Don Johnson, baby.
Oh, my God.
Now, that guy's a heartthrob from the 80s.
Yeah, back when he was all coked up. So, all right. So, as it stands, though, tonight we are talking about Inglourious Basterds, which I was able to rent from, not rent, but check out from my library. It's been hilarious because I've been torturing Holden with it.
Hey, now
with just the title, because he's like So he was doing something over by the DVD player earlier, and he said, what's the movie in the DVD player? Because he was cleaning up. We had a stack of movies there from the kids watching movies this weekend and stuff. I said, oh, he said, is that the movie you're doing for the podcast? I said, yeah. He said, okay. I said, what's the name of that movie? He looked at me like, what are you doing? And he said, something, something, the other B word.
Nice. Well, he's smart, man. Yeah. His dad's setting him up to get grounded.
He did,
that's,
he did
that's
not take
cold,
the bait.
Dad.
He did not take the bait. But, yeah, I was able to get the Blu-ray. And
oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what we were watching right there at the
yep.
end there?
Yeah, I was was playing around with the 7 and downloaded the...
The 7. I love it.
I downloaded the Pocket Blue app, which is it's an app that gives you bonus content on your Android device based on the DVD. This was wild. So I downloaded the app because as I put the DVD in, the screen pops up and says, hey, download the Pocket Blue app for Android, you know, iOS, whatever. So I did. I went out and grabbed it, and I'm playing with this app, and as the DVD is loading up, next thing you know, on my screen, on the 7, it just pops up, Inglourious Basterds, the Blu-ray of Inglourious Basterds has been found on a Blu-ray player on your network. Do you want to attach to it now?
Is this Google Now?
No. This is the Pocket Blue app.
Pocket Blue app.
So I said, yes. And it brought me into the app.
Interesting.
And it gives me kind of a play-by-play. So as I'm looking at the screen, it's showing me what chapter I'm watching. It automatically unlocked some bonus content. So there was some little clips, interview clips and things like that that were available right on my device. I didn't watch them because I was too busy just trying to watch the movie.
Right.
But it was pretty sweet. And
that's cool, man.
A ton of movies that are tied into this Pocket Blue system. It's pretty sweet.
And the app's free?
Yeah, it's a free app.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, let's go ahead and talk about the movie. What did you guys think?
Well, I thought I've seen this movie before in the theaters. I've seen it, just watched it again. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize just how tedious the first part of the movie was. It gets interesting as it moves along. I still enjoyed it. I mean, there's still a lot to this thing. It works on a whole bunch of different levels, the music, the story. It's a very Quentin Tarantino story. You can see his fingerprints all over it. But it is a strange alternative World War II movie. Sometimes always interesting, sometimes very disturbing.
I'll say it is a Tarantino movie, definitely. I think, though, it's a cut above all of his other movies. I'm a big fan of it.
Mm-hmm.
I bought the movie. I even own the soundtrack. I love the soundtrack to it. It's a lot of Ennio Morricone music on it. It's one of the better movies I've ever seen because I think it takes something that Tarantino is really good at. A lot of blood, a lot of violence, a lot of unpredictability, and applies it to a scenario where that was really true.
Yes.
Which elevates the narrative and makes it one of the more powerful and intense films I've ever seen because when someone does something in Inglourious Basterds, unlike other Tarantino films where it's a mark of the genre, it's a mark of history. It could have happened.
Yeah.
And that is disturbing and revealing on an entirely different level.
Yeah, where a lot of Tarantino movies, you question the reality or the plausibility of a situation like that being maintained over the course of the story without outside involvement, without police getting involved, without... you know, some kind of enforcement of a situation. There was no reason for any of that in that period of time, in that place, with what was going on. For the antagonist to be a Nazi officer, that's reasonable. That he would have been just a cold-hearted bastard and nobody to question him. Who's going to question him? He's the boss. The only people that can question him are the people under him, and they're not going to. There's no way they're going to.
And there's an interesting element of politeness and European propriety that plays against the violence that also doesn't happen in his other movies. Obviously, there's a lot of conversation mm-hmm. in his other films. But as an American, when you watch a film that's 75% in foreign language, in European, and there's a certain sense of it's German, so I don't want to call it Victorianism, but there's definitely a kind of European propriety that's there, a gentlemanness that, and then when you see a Nazi officer break from that and kill someone, it's
kind of a veiled evil.
Yes, exactly, and it's much more effective.
Well, yeah, because you don't expect someone who is so urbane and well spoken to just suddenly turn like a rabid animal on you and just become this monster. And that's another fun thing about this movie, is you've got a look at the evil of all three of them, of Shoshona, of Aldo, and Lana. I mean, each one of them has a certain weird morality to them. Lana seems to think, like, I'm a man doing a job, and I'm very good at what I do, and I'm very proud of that. Aldo is just nothing but a thug. I mean, he's proud of what he does because he's been selected to finish this war.
He's going
to
kill himself some Nazis.
He's right. That's the only thing he's out to do. And he's going to do it any way he can. Shoshone, on the other hand, she's just out for revenge. And it doesn't bother her, you know, to murder 350 people if it gets back at them for what they did to her family.
Yeah, although, I mean, I would say that I find the motivations of Aldo and Shoshana at least more palatable than Hans Landa, who is pure evil.
No, he's and not any more pure evil than the others.
I think Hans Landa is a terribly intelligent person.
He's super intelligent, yes.
Who is bored. I get the sense that he is a bored sociopath. I mean, and if you look at it, his actions, most of them come out of a situation where it's like, he doesn't have to be that cruel, but he likes pushing buttons. He likes seeing what people do to react. And much like, he's very much like Tony Stark in the Avengers pushing Bruce Banner's buttons, where he's like, he just wanted to see what makes him tick. What's going to make him pop? What's going to make him turn into the Hulk? He's like, he's got complete control of almost every situation that he's in. And he just flexes that control and sees just how far he can push the situation and get exactly what he wants. Because in his mind, he's worked out all the angles, and mm-hmm. it's all a foregone conclusion anyway. The only variable is how the other person's going to react. So what can he do to make the other person react? And he did it over and over again. And it started right in and of itself, the beginning of the movie.
Hans Landa likes to mind fuck people. That's what he's doing.
And in and of itself, it's brilliant, because if you are a person who is in a bureaucracy and has the job of ratting people out, the way you do it is you get themselves to rat themselves out. Yeah. You don't say, did you do, you know, you let them do.
They know they're guilty. He's just trying to get you to admit it.
Just admit it.
Let's make this one of the better characters that ever was on screen. I mean, it's a phenomenal character.
He really is a good character.
And it's not that he's a full character, because the guy is pure evil. I mean, there's nothing about him where you go, oh yeah, I can understand that character. There's nothing to understand about him, except for the fact that he's completely calculated sociopath. And every time you watch the film, you come away fascinated by his propriety and his gentlemanliness, and then his abrupt cruelty. I mean, he's just a phenomenal character.
And if you look at it throughout the movie, he does have a motivating factor that you don't find out about until the last 10 minutes of the movie.
And I guess I missed that. He wants to get out.
Yeah. Because the only thing he can't control is what the people above him are doing.
Right.
Who's above him? Those five.
Yeah.
And if those five guys go, the war is over. And you know what? Then he's free to do whatever he wants, because nobody can tell him not to. You know, and he's siphoned off some money, so he's sitting pretty there. He's just gonna walk away free and clear, and he's got all the angles worked out.
That's a bingo. That's just bingo. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's a great character.
Yes, but what he don't count on is the wild card, that someone actually could be more cruel than he is. He expects Aldo essentially at the end to
be a gentleman.
To be a gentleman like him. Aldo's no gentleman. Aldo's a thug. That's all he is. He said, oh, I'm just going to get chewed out. I mean,
I've been chewed out before. I don't care.
You know, you made the deal with my command. I did not.
I like Aldo.
And they didn't give me any orders other than to deliver you.
I know Aldo's, he's a thug and he's kind of this unrefined guy.
Oh, he's not unrefined.
I like the simplicity of his character
in his own way, he can be just as cruel and sociopathic, though, as
Hans Lock.
Yeah, he can. Yeah. Because there are ways that they kill some of those people that go beyond just mercifully killing someone.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. There's no doubt that one of the interesting things about this film is the film is not really about the Inglourious Basterds at all.
No.
They're almost a side story, but they're kind of a umbrella topic under which the whole movie can be told. So they call it the Inglourious Basterds. I think to some extent Tarantino just wants to pay homage to an old film that I've never seen, and I don't think any of you guys have ever seen, called the Inglourious Basterds. But the Basterds are this group of,
terrorists. That's about all
they are. They're terrorists.
Londo even calls him a terrorist.
Yeah, I think he does say that. Yeah.
Well, actually, they are because they're not wearing any uniform.
But there is a uniqueness to their. But I think it's interesting. I mean, let's put Aldo aside. I mean, he is a American, non-Jewish, but the rest of them are Jewish,
right?
And they have a very specific motivation.
Oh yeah, it's revenge.
Yeah, and. You know, I don't necessarily, I mean, with the exception of the fact that Aldo has appropriated them for U.S. military purposes, I don't necessarily think that there's anything to be, you know, upset about from the fact that they're torturing Nazis.
He didn't appropriate them. They volunteered.
Right, right.
You almost wondered just how legitimate that lieutenant rank is.
Well, no kidding. I mean, you know, maybe they're all AWOL for crying out loud.
Yeah, I mean, he very definitely could be.
Yeah.
He's just out there. Killing him some Nazis.
Right.
Which, I loved his cadence and his tone and how he spoke. It was fantastic.
I think it was a throwback to a lot of John Wayne stuff from the war films. And I think it was both a, like, appreciation of and a...
A little like humor.
Yeah.
A little humor.
Yeah.
Like, when when Londa keeps asking him to speak Italian, he comes up like,
Bonjour.
Bonjour. Arrivederci.
It's like, he's more Italian than the MGM line is my grandmother, yeah.
I really like the line where he's like, back in Tennessee where we do something that we call moonshine, and for us to just make a living, but the government says against the law. And, like, I forget what he says, but it's something along those lines, and... And he's trying to explain something to Hans Landa, but it's just a very good plainness that seems authentic to the character.
Yeah. I love Brad Pitt in these roles where he's just this character.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's somebody that is just so not Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point where, he almost seems to thrive in those roles. So it's, you almost, after watching enough movies, it's like you almost can't identify who Brad Pitt is.
Mm-hmm. In some ways.
Where you see half a dozen Tom Cruise movies, and probably four or five of them, you're going to get the Tom Cruise character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some exceptions, but, I mean, Days of Thunder, Top Gun, Risky Business. Mm-hmm. You get this trend of characters, and then you throw in a movie, Tropic Thunder, and it's like,
Tropic Thunder
what just happened? Yeah. It is.
When an actor plays against his own type, it gets interesting.
And then it gets obvious. Where Brad Pitt, it's like you don't know what you're ever really going to get when he's there.
Yeah, because
and I like that.
Because Tom Cruise, when he's parodying himself, it's more or less still about him and his personality. Yeah. But with Brad Pitt, it really is about, you know, hey, I just wanted to be this guy in this film, and that's cool.
It's cool. I like it.
One of the things that was interesting to me is I watched an interview with Pitt and Tarantino, and Pitt was like, so I go to Tarantino, and I just kind of go to him and go, you know how the war really ended, right? And Tarantino's like, yeah, I know. And Pitt's basically like, so we didn't talk about how it ended. Well, but I wanted to make sure he knew before I did the movie or something like that, because it's like, because this is so absurd and ridiculous that... So, yeah, it seems like he doesn't take himself too seriously, which is pretty cool.
I enjoy when actors of a certain caliber, or not only actors, but actors, musicians, entertainers of a certain caliber don't take themselves too seriously. Yeah. I have so much more respect, even if I don't care for what they do in every aspect, like Justin Timberlake. When he, you know, I did not care for his music at all. But the first time he showed up on SNL, just making fun of who he was and what he did, it's like, you know what? My respect just went up to you a billion times.
Yeah.
I'm not going to buy your CD, but man, I get you now, and you're cool. You
know? Yeah,
I'm cool with you now. And that's kind of how I feel with Brad Pitt too.
Yeah, I mean it. His character basically is, to me, was John Wayne.
Yeah,
for better or for worse. All of the trappings, the positives and negatives that come with being that caricature, that's who he was. And sure. That was cool to me. And I mean, I think we're kind of ignoring, probably not consciously, but I think we're ignoring the main character, which is Shoshana.
Mm-hmm.
She's basically the center of the film. She has the primary motivation that affects the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if anyone has any comments on that. I had never heard of that actress before. I thought she did a great job.
Yeah.
I thought it was very interesting. It's Tarantino's thing about film and
I know,
German film and
well, it's films in general. I mean, the whole, of course, the part of the story revolves around a theater and a movie within a movie,
right?
Because you still have Pride of the Nation,
yes,
or Nation's Pride, excuse me, working there too. And I like how she tailors her revenge to be a film.
Yeah,
and when you say the film within a film too, her little short.
You're right. Yeah, it's a film within a film within a film.
And hers was the only her attack was the only thing that worked.
Yeah, because nobody else really had
a coherent plan. I mean, no. It all had gone to crap.
And some of the plans were really dumb. I mean, that was one of the other things I think was funny about the movie is it made fun of a lot of war planning, mm-hmm. like in films, like you know where they're like. Yeah, we're gonna meet in this place, and it's gonna be fine. And he's like, "Well, all I see is it's fine in a basement, you know." And it's basically like, "This is a joke. This is a horrible idea." And the Europeans are like, "No, no, this is a great idea." And Aldo Raine's like, "Yeah, well, it's fine in a basement." And sure enough, it becomes a complete disaster.
Yeah,
despite everything. Yes, I thought you said there weren't supposed to be any Germans. Well, there usually isn't.
Yeah, right.
And so, that's another little Tarantino trademark is the unexpected guests, you might say. You didn't expect these people to be here, but they become part of the story too, or they mess up the story.
Yeah, and it's really brilliant. I mean, it's what he does in a lot of films, but to me it just held more weight here, where they're playing a game. I don't know what kind
it's like
of
charades.
It is. Yeah, and they try to guess who the person is, and they have certain clues and stuff. And
yeah, with the
yeah,
the forehead, the card on the forehead.
And the whole time, you're obviously thinking about the subplot in the background, but no one talks about it. And this is a good 20 minutes of film and dialogue.
Where, that,
yes.
You know what? Honestly, that's where I fell asleep last night when I was watching it. Because because I started watching the movie at 11 o'clock. And I'd seen the movie before, so it was just a matter of rewatching it for the podcast. And it got to that scene, and it was like, man, I could not keep my eyes open.
But
and
that's like, the one other Tarantino feature was you get this endless dialogue, and then suddenly, boom!
Yes.
Everything just goes to hell.
Oh my gosh, there's so many. Everyone's got their gun pointed at somebody else at the end of that scene, mm-hmm. and they just. And I remember the first time I saw this, I watched it with my brother. He needed to step out and have a cigarette. So I'm like, yeah, sure. So we pause it. And we're in the middle of the whole bit about King Kong or whatever. And it's just gone on forever.
Yeah.
And he's like, so what do you think? Who do you think's on, you know, this or that? And I said, well, you know, I think the guy knows. But it kind of illustrated. We basically discussed what was all going on in our subconscious while he took a cigarette break because we had the opportunity to.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, that scene would have played out and we would have been like, what, you know, WTF, man, what's going on, you know? So that's a great scene. There's a lot of great scenes in that movie, you know? So
if actually you've almost got kind of like three movies running inside this thing. I mean, you could take any one of these things out and make a movie on its own.
Yeah, I would agree.
And they would stand alone quite well. I mean, Shoshana's Revenge in the Theater, Aldo's Inglourious Basterds, Lana's Constant Pursuit. And there's another, again, tension scene where Lana and Munette are sitting at the dinner table there. And you know, the idea is she's been invited by Bauer to be told that, you know, her theater is going to be selected for the premiere. And, you know, she's sitting there getting ready to get up, and then all of a sudden this hand's on her shoulder, pushing her back down, saying, "Not so quiet, fast." And you can see her tension and relief build and build and build and then come down. And, like, she's trying to mask her terror because she knows who Hans Lana is. She's already heard his voice, if not seen his face.
Right.
But he doesn't know her. He's only seen the back of her head when she's running.
It's an interesting point because a friend of mine who saw the movie thought he knew who she was. He kind of saw Hans Landa as omniscient. He, you know, that Hans Landa always knew, but that he decided when to react and when not to react because it was his element of control.
Well, that was the thing is when he handed her the glass of milk, I was wondering, yes. Okay, hold on. This is, did he know or not?
Yes. It's very good, very good scene. I mean, the whole movie's like that. The whole movie is based on scenes where everything is on the surface really great, so to speak, but underneath you wonder what everyone's motivation really is. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm kind of a fanboy at this point of the movie, but
I'm looking through some of the trivia, and there's some crazy stuff in here. In Legends of the Fall, Brad Pitt plays a man who scalps two German soldiers and gets involved in bootlegging. In this film, he plays the leader of a group that scalps German soldiers and mentions a past involvement in bootlegging. In Quentin Tarantino's universe, quote-unquote universe, the character of Lieutenant Aldo Raine is Floyd's, a.k.a. the pothead on the couch from True Romance's great-grandfather.
Now, how do they know that?
I don't know. But it's Brad Pitt in both cases, so.
It's true, but I mean, where are they? I mean, they got to pull it from somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, one of the other little trivia things was that this story was written 10 years.
Yeah, it took 10 years to write it.
Well, 10 years off and on. He wrote it, and he couldn't figure out how to end it. And he went off and he put it off to the side for a while and did two other movies and then came back to it. And figured out how to finish it and then turn it into a workable screenplay.
Yes.
And there's a
which
part
he said
me,
was harder than writing it in the first place.
There's a part of me who was like, well, the ending was good, but maybe it could have been better. But then I think about it in my mind and I go, well, what would the alternate ending be? I don't know. I don't know what the alternate ending would be, you know, so...
Well, the alternate ending is they'd all die, that Lana would betray them.
Yeah, I suppose.
I mean, he didn't end the war. He just took them to someplace else where he could kill them, and it was all a lie.
And you know who played the cameo? There was a couple of cameo roles, but mm-hmm. You know who played the narrator, right?
Yes, Sam Jackson.
That was Sam Jackson. Mm-hmm. Harvey Keitel actually had a voice credit in it, too.
Really?
The voice of the American officer negotiating on the wireless radio with Raine and Landa at the end.
Nice.
Yeah. I did not realize Mike Myers was in this movie.
Yes.
Me. Yes. Holy crap. Isn't that amazing? The makeup and everything. And it's a totally straight play.
Yeah.
And who's the guy in the background?
He's another well-known actor who did a cameo role.
Is he supposed to be Winston Churchill?
Yes, he was Winston Churchill. Let's see if we can find out who he was here. It is Rod Taylor.
Rod Taylor, okay.
Who did the cameo of Winston Churchill, and he was very effective. I couldn't figure out why he was there in the first place initially, but until he starts talking with the other officer, apparently he's there to hear the story. Because one of Churchill's big things in real life was he liked to get involved in these convoluted plots. He's a real, you might call him a real fanboy of the
espionage and whatnot, yeah,
and crazy, crazy ideas.
So, last two pieces of trivia. Both of these are about the Bear Jew's bat. One of the Jewish names carved on the bat is Anne Frank.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
And a deleted scene reveals the origins of the Bear Jew's bat. This scene was still in the film during the screening at Cannes.
Wow.
There is apparently once a rumor going around, and I'm not finding that clip here directly. Here it is, that Harvey Weinstein was trying to force Tarantino to cut 40 minutes of the movie after getting feedback from Cannes. Harvey denied the rumor, stating that Tarantino was reorganizing some scenes since he didn't have enough time to completely finish editing the film before sending it to Cannes, since he was given only 6 weeks to edit, whereas other directors are normally given 6 months to a year. In fact, the theatrical cut runs 1 minute longer than the cut that premiered at Cannes.
Wow.
Well, that's pretty phenomenal editing speed. I guess it shows you, again, Tarantino is not only a good director, he's a very good film editor, too.
Apparently, that's how Kevin Smith actually does daily editing.
Mm-hmm.
He actually edits day of.
Supposed to bring the movie back. Sorry.
Rumor has it that Clerks 3 will be a book before it's a movie.
Really?
Yes.
It'll be hard to top Clerks 2. That was a pretty good movie.
I enjoyed Clerks 2.
I really did enjoy it.
I did.
Basically, this story about Tony lent me this like 2 months ago. I've probably watched it almost 10 times now.
I don't know where you're going to take it after that.
It was wonderful.
It was a pretty satisfying ending.
Yeah,
it really was. It wrapped up everything so nicely. I mean, the only thing that you can really do, and that's not what he's doing, apparently, I would have said was take it 10 years further.
Yeah.
Do another 10 years and pick up at that. From the way it sounds, he's going back, and I don't know, I don't agree with some of this, but he's going back and showing how Randall and Dante met in kindergarten. And it sounds like he's advancing through their lives a chapter at a time. But he's releasing each chapter on the internet and then getting fan feedback before he writes the next chapter. That's disappointing.
Well, I don't know if it's, you're a bigger fan than I am, but I don't know if it's not disappointing.
I am not as much a fan as I used to be.
Really? Well, yeah, I know you told me about that, but I guess the thing is,
I'm disappointed in a writer doing that and not owning his story.
Right.
But people do it all the time now. I mean, I guess back in the day, I would agree. But I guess I feel like it happens so often now, it doesn't really matter anymore. Like if you decided as a writer, let's say you were an established writer, and you decided that your audience didn't matter in this age of instant communication, what would that mean? I'm going to
dispute that. It's not that I don't care, but a creative work that I'm doing is mine. I don't mind the criticism after it's finished and whatnot, but what is out, what I create is out there. I'm not going to just undo it because a few dozen people disagree with me. I mean, I'll let my editor tell me that, but I'm not going to let an audience, which I really don't know anything about. I mean, they're trying to make my work their work.
I totally agree, except to say that if I had to choose between the audience that loves me and the studio, I would choose the audience. And I think maybe in the modern time, that's where we're at today. I don't know. I mean,
I still, as a consumer of his media, I don't want the story that his fans create.
Right.
Because quite frankly, I think what destroyed him is his fans.
Really?
And the feeding frenzy that they
created. The fact that they hated Jersey Girl is pretty cold, because that's a great movie.
It is a great
movie. And the fact that he, like, doesn't defend it is kind of raw.
He wrote that as basically a love letter to his father, who died before the movie was released in theaters.
Yeah.
Now he talks about it like it's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
If you read interviews,
but that has more to do with Bennifer than it does to do with anything that he did, really.
It does. And it was only because of Gigli, which was released before Jersey Girl because of a contractual obligation, that killed that movie. The plan was to release that movie before Gigli and to make it just look like a love story between the two of them, letting everybody think that the Jersey Girl is her, not giving away the fact that in the first 10, 15 minutes of the movie, you basically get foreshadowing what happened in Up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's,
I mean, that the beginning is that impactful. I mean, it just shows you how strong a filmmaker he can be when he wants to be, when he's not sitting around smoking dope. And
yeah, I agree. And if to put it in my terms, if Scorsese like sold out and did some kind of crap movie just to satisfy fans, I'd be pretty disappointed. But on the other hand, I can see Kevin Smith trying to preserve his career in some way, because that's kind of what he
is. But he's going to retire. He's going to retire as a director. But he just keeps adding projects to that.
If you want to salvage your career, make better movies.
Yeah, but I don't really. To this point, I don't have a problem with any of the movies I've seen.
Comic books. Do something.
Granted, I've only seen up to Clerks 2, but I mean, I think the weakest one was Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, because that was fan service film.
It was absolutely.
But I'm okay with that, because I think it's kind of neat that someone would take the time to cater to fans in that
way. It was fun, but it was still disappointing, because I wanted more out of him, not just wanking off to the fans.
But then he does Jersey Girl after that, so I mean, you can't.
I know
you can't say he's not doing both, because he is in a way.
Yeah, and for me, I was feeling so much better about him after Jersey Girl and Clerks 2, because it's like, these are great movies.
Yeah,
they're back to the heart of what he's about and what he's doing. Then he makes Zack and Miri make a porno, which is a funny movie.
I've never seen it. So.
Don't get me wrong. It is a hilarious movie. But it's a step backwards. From the steps that he took, it was kind of a step backwards. And then he goes on to make Red State, which I am on record not liking.
Yeah, you're on record with me. I don't know if you...
we did a podcast, so I am on record.
Okay. Yeah. You told me. You guys have already done it. Yeah. So. It's interesting. Well, to bring it back to Tarantino briefly... one of my buddies is a huge fan, and this was one of his least favorite movies.
Really?
And I thought that was interesting, because it kind of reminded me of the Kevin Smith thing, where I was kind of like, you know, here Tarantino does something that's, I would call it riskier. I mean, it was a wildly successful film, so in the end it paid off, so right. Maybe it's not as much of a risk in hindsight, but I think it's a riskier film than what he traditionally does, and I think it was a phenomenal film.
Yeah.
I think it kind of fulfills his promise as a director in a way, which up until now, you just kind of, well, he does some interesting kitschy 70s stuff, but what is he going to do when he gets out of that? And Inglourious Bastards is what he ended up doing, I think, to some extent.
I think what's interesting about Inglourious Bastards, and it makes you consume a Tarantino movie in a different way.
Yeah.
Because... And I think my initial problem with the movie was that I felt it was slow. I felt the pacing was weird. The thing is, the pacing in this movie isn't a whole lot different than it is in like Jackie Brown or Pulp Fiction. The difference is, instead of consuming that quick dialogue, the rambling dialogue that doesn't seem to be going anywhere, but is totally about the characters and totally getting you into their headspace, and then the weird stuff happens, is that you're not listening to it because you don't, I mean, I don't speak German. I don't speak Italian. I'm having to read it. So it feels different, even though really it's the same. And I thought, I kind of thought, you know, kind of analyzing it this time watching through, it's like, it's really not a whole lot different. It's just that you have to consume it in a different way, using a different headspace. You're not just listening along. You have to interact with it by reading it. And so it takes it just invests you a little more in what they're saying.
I mean, I would completely agree. I think it's almost more tense.
Yeah.
To be in a foreign language. Because.
Especially if you know Tarantino movies.
Yeah.
Once they get into that basement and they're talking and everything, and you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know it's coming because he always does it. And you're getting toward the point in the movie where something like this has got to happen. I'm going to shoot your German balls off. You know?
Well, I might as well go out speaking the Kings then. I just love that. But you have any...
One of the last thing we probably want to talk about is the music.
Yes.
All over the place. Starts off with Spaghetti Western.
Yes.
Then moves into a rock anthem. Moves around to the Marshall music, and then finally ends up with another
sort of spaghetti western style opera closing. I mean, the soundtrack alone is worth the movie.
It's a wonderful soundtrack. I think the main, what I would consider the main theme, I don't know if there's a main theme, but what I would consider is the, in a way, the Empire Strikes Back type march, the bump, 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 bump. And that's a Morricone piece, which is an Italian piece. But it definitely feels like a, I don't know, you want to call it a, like a Nazi march piece? I mean, well, it just feels very...
like a military march. You know,
yeah, imperious.
Imperious.
Yeah.
And then it takes that weird section with the David Bowie section.
Yes.
On cat people, which works perfectly for Mumet's thoughts of what she's going to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, the lyrics are pretty much what's going on in her head.
Yeah. And that in and of itself is a great, like, I guess we didn't talk maybe about the revenge plot and all that, but she's very meticulous and
she's very present-minded and meticulous. Yes, she knows as soon. This was, you know, the great thing that happened—a chance meeting between the guy who's the focus of the film. He gets the entire Nazi high command into her theater. Oh, this is what I've been waiting for. I want to kill all these bastards. They're bringing them right to me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have the perfect method. 300 cans of nitrate film. Sitting
right
in my basement, the bomb would need to go off.
I thought that was very interesting because I didn't know nitrate. I mean, I don't know anything about film.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they made the historical point that nitrate film was incredibly flammable, and they even show a little like stock footage where the guy's like, "I'd like to bring this nitrate film onto a trolley." It was like, "You can't bring that; it's illegal or whatever."
Yeah.
I just thought that was very interesting too.
Well, that's the problem is a lot of old theaters did meet their end that way because
really
they didn't send the prints back; they just stored them in the basement. And nitrate stock, unless it's kept cold, turns into nitrocellulose, which is gunpowder, and it's highly explosive and highly flammable. And she's got plenty of it there.
So
that's very interesting.
It's interesting that you mentioned spaghetti western because Tarantino actually intended this movie to be a cross between a war film and a spaghetti western. Apparently, he even was considering the title of the movie to be "Once Upon a Time in Nazi Occupied France."
Yes, because that's the opening.
The opening
chapter,
the first chapter. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's based on Sergio Leone's "Once Upon a Time in the West." Upon a Time in. What was
the Good,
what
Bad,
was,
and the Ugly? Half
yeah,
a dozen.
What's the DocuSucker has an "Once Upon a Time in Something." "Once Upon a Time in the Revolution,"
mm-hmm.
and "Once Upon a Time in America." There's more Sergio Leone references in this movie than.
Well, Sergio Leone is such an icon.
Yeah.
For film scores and for these, I guess called iconic cinematography.
Yeah.
Of messed up, I should say. Complex characters in a very, very desperate situation.
And that opening scene with him washing his... Is he washing his hands or is he washing his face? Or I don't know. He's
yes,
out there.
Yes, we're the dairy farmer character. Yes.
And it's straight out of Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Where they're drawing water, they're washing themselves before they go in and have this long meeting with this guy who's going to do him in. I mean, it's flawless the way he pulls it off.
It's so... When asked how he got into the violent baseball bat wielding mindset of the Bear Jew, Eli Roth partially attributed his performance to the historically accurate costumes. Quote, "Being in wool underwear will make you want to kill anything." Unquote.
He also, summertime.
This is the best part. He also stated in a separate interview that his girlfriend had secretly added some Hannah Montana music onto his iPod. When he listened to it, it inexplicably made him able to tap into the violent nature of the Bear Jew.
And also the final thing
that's
is
awesome.
There really is a Bear Jew.
Really?
Yes. It is a football player who is in the NFL who is Jewish, and he is quite big. His buddies gave him the moniker Bear Jew. Yes,
that's
here
fantastic.
It is. When the Jewish 6'7", 314-pound American football player Gabe Carmelli was drafted in the 2011 NFL draft, first round by the Bears, he was nicknamed the Bear Jew as a reference to the character in Inglourious Basterds.
I guess I got something to bring up because I don't know if it'll ever come up again. My namesake, for better or worse, I don't know. I never heard of this guy.
there is a guy called the Nazi Hunter, and he's a Jewish German, apparently, and his name is
Simon Wiesenthal.
Anton Kunzel.
Oh, Anton Kunzel.
Ah. Yeah.
And apparently he really hunted Nazis for the better part of 50 years.
Wow.
Between 1940 and 1990. I don't know anything else about it, but I found that very interesting. Somebody told me about that when they heard my name. I said, oh, are you related to someone? I'm like, I don't think so, but I don't know. Maybe I am. I don't know. So I thought that was very interesting. So, and yeah, he hunted Nazis, brought them to justice. So I thought,
oh my God, he died less than a year ago.
Really? Did you see?
Looked him up. Yeah,
Anton. Okay.
The death of the Nazi hunter. Last week, Anton Kunzel died in Tel Aviv, momentarily emerged from the shadows of anonymity to enforce on the Mossad operatives. Jeez.
Yeah. So, I'm never gonna live up to that guy's name, but I thought that was pretty cool that. Yeah, I forget who I heard that from. Oh, but somebody asked me about it. I said, I don't know anything about that guy. Like, oh, yeah. Yeah, he hunts Nazis. And I was like, all right, cool. So
he finds people who don't want to be found.
That's apparently.
Like my.
It sounds like he was probably Mossad or.
Mossad, yeah. Yeah. Looks like he was Mossad.
Yeah.
There's a Nat Geo television show called The Nazi Hunters. I'm looking this stuff up. Posing as a successful Austrian businessman and former Nazi lieutenant named Anton Kunzel, an undercover Mossad spy, makes contact with such and such. Master plan begins to unfold. Impressed by Kunzel's apparent wealth and success, Kukurs readily admits he's a war criminal, but earning his trust and luring him out of the country proved more challenging. Wow.
You know more about it than I ever knew. Just looking it up on the internet. Yeah, I haven't had time to even look into it.
But apparently this is just... Apparently that was just a name they used. That's not even...
That's not even his real name, probably. Guy. It's just probably a German name he took to...
Somebody used that just to get this guy.
Interesting.
Apparently that was the guy's... The name he used when he was hunting Nazis... That might not have been his real name. He was an undercover Mossad agent. And that's the
it
name
probably
he was going
not his real, there's no way it was real.
And that's
real
the
name
he was going by.
I mean, it's a totally German name. You know,
he heard
the reason I know this is because I'm 100% friggin' German. I mean, that's where my family came from.
Heard the podcast. Right. And knew that you were going when you went on hiatus. And he's like, I'm going to totally steal that guy's identity. Nobody's going to know when they look him up. They're going to find the podcast and realize he's out.
This also obviously brings in the ninja storylines, all the things you told while I was gone. Obviously, this is what I've been
doing.
It's
you.
Yeah. It's got to be, right? I mean, so.
True Confessions.
Yeah.
This ninja is Nazi Hunter. An autobiographical cathartic.
Unbelievable. The author of the book is called Anton Kunz. Okay, so I'm seeing it now, too.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
It is kind of cool. I mean, I don't think I've looked into it even till like right now. So very cool. Well, I can't top that, so I got nothing else.
The chat room is interesting. Apparently, Stingray has joined Lena, and Lena tells Stingray that Jeff is running late for backseat box office, so she's hanging out. And Stingray says, "Yeah, nice. I'm building rockets."
Nice.
Well, trying to. And she has actual rockets, video game rockets, but they're based on real rocket science. Wow. Okay. So I think we've got an episode.
We're pretty much wrapped up here with Inglourious Bastards.
Yeah. Yeah. So next week,
maybe Django Unchained. Maybe. We'll see.
Depending on how many of us get
maybe
to see
we'll,
it.
Maybe we'll go find that episode of Nazi Hunters and just watch that.
We should freaking do that, dude. I'd be totally all about that.
Okay. I guess we'll see you guys next week.
All right. Peace out.
Goodbye.